Thank you very much. It's a real joy to be here with you. Thank you. And just to talk a little bit about Asylum, you may have noticed it's in the news a bit. So I want to talk a bit about my own experience with that, our agency's experience, some of the things that are going on now that are real challenges to asylum seekers, and then I want to leave time for questions because I suspect you'll have a few. I want to start with, interestingly enough, for a lawyer, I want to start with a view of Scripture. I love the series, your Lenten series, and the question, who is our neighbor? Of course, that comes from the wonderful parable Jesus told about the Good Samaritan, and I've wondered how Jesus would tell that parable today, because the Samaritans were so reviled at the time, and that's why Jesus chose them as a comparison. I wonder if Jesus was telling that story today, if he would say the good Syrian refugee, or the good young man escaping gang violence from El Salvador, those groups that are marginalized and demonized by society. And I wonder, and I think that's a worthy thing for us to pause and think about. But the scripture I want to start with is one that's very dear to me, and it sets the tone for what I want to talk about tonight, and it's the 58th chapter of Isaiah. And in that chapter, the prophet says this, "Is this not the fast which I choose, to loosen the bonds of wickedness, to undo the bands of the yoke, and to let the oppressed go free and break every yoke? Is it not to divide your bread with the hungry and to bring the homeless poor into the house, when you see the naked to cover them, and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? Then your light will break out like dawn, and your recovery will speedily spring forth, and your righteousness will go before you, and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard." Those are beautiful words, but the reason they have such meaning for me is it starts by asking this question, is this not the fast I choose? And so what the prophet is doing there is saying that working with oppressed people is just as much an act of worship as the beautiful songs and prayers and ceremonies that we observe as Christians. And for me, working with asylum seekers, as I have for the last 30 years, is not a good deed, but rather an act of worship. Because God himself identifies with marginalized people and with oppressed people. And so when I'm working with an asylum seeker, just like the book of Matthew tells us, I feel like I'm serving Jesus himself. And then, of course, there's further biblical basis for our work with refugees and asylum seekers and in general, immigrants. All through the Hebrew scriptures, there's admonitions, reminders to the Jews that, such as in Exodus, "You shall not oppress a stranger, since you are yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, and you were strangers yourself in the land of Egypt." And it was interesting that that the Bible is very clear in reminding people, remember you were strangers, remember who you are, remember where you were from. So how did I get here as this in this work? You know, I meet young lawyers all the time, passionate human rights activists, and the young generation, the millennials, these are people that are really dedicated to social justice and doing something meaningful in their life. That was not me. I went to law school. I got out in 1981, and I just wanted to get out and make a living and support myself. That was really the breadth of my goal. So along the way, though, it's just funny how life has a way of directing you. I was doing criminal defense work, and I had a client from El Salvador who was a burglar. And I was representing, it was a court-appointed case, and I got a call at my office from Brad Ginter. Still remember his name. And he said, Bill, I'm Brad, I'm a Mennonite missionary, and I'm here working with the Central American community. I know that you're representing this guy. And he gave me his name. And I went, yeah. And he said, have you visited him in jail yet? And I said, yes, I have. And he said, well, what are you going to do on his case? And I said, who are you? And he said, well, as I said, I'm a Mennonite missionary. I'm sure you're familiar with the Salvadoran Civil War. This would have been about 1984, 85. And I said, not really. And he said, well, there's civil wars in El Salvador and Guatemala. There's thousands of people fleeing those wars. They're making their way all over the United States. They're coming to Dallas. I'm here working with that community. And then I said something, and I gave this no thought at all, and it changed my whole life. I said, well, if you ever need a hand, give me a call. Yeah. I can see many of you by your laughter have had similar experiences in your life. And he did. He started calling me, and I started, interestingly enough, with what's going on in the country today, I started off representing, doing legal services for unaccompanied minors from Central America. And it was different then. There was really no legal relief, no immigration relief available for them. So all I was really doing was helping brothers, or the kids were up here because their parents were dead or missing. And so they're up here living with a brother or sister or aunt and uncle, and I was helping them get guardianship so they can enroll the kids in school. And then I took an asylum law training through Catholic Charities. My first client was a woman from Guatemala, a young woman. She and her husband was a leader in a trucker's labor union. And they were taking their kids to school one morning, and an unmarked car pulled up, grabbed him, pulled him into the car, and took off. About 2 days later, she was called to come identify his body in the morgue. His body had been dumped outside of town, and then she started trying to investigate what had happened to him, and then she started getting death threats, and she realized then that her husband had been murdered by a death squad. And so it was going to the police and trying to get help from them just to actually put her and her family in jeopardy. So they left and made their way up here. She was in her 20s. She had two small children. She made here, traveled to the United States. She made her way to Dallas to this agency. I can't remember if it was Catholic Charities or Proyecto Adelante, which was a group that was doing this work in the early 90s and late 80s. But it was through one of those agencies, and I took that case, and I went and I assisted her in getting asylum. And I thought, okay, this is the most meaningful thing I've ever done as a lawyer. I want to do another one of those cases. And then, well, then 30 years passed. Because over and over again, I had those kinds of experiences. Because, you know, most lawyers go through their whole career and they may, you know, do very high quality legal work, or they may do things that are lucrative. But, you know, you don't always get a chance to change somebody's life, and you definitely don't get the chance very often to actually save somebody's life. And so it's addictive, honestly, to take one of these cases. Now, our agency, as I said, is 19 years old. It was started by Betsy Healy, who is a lawyer with a big law firm downtown, and Serena Conley, who was connected with the Simmons Foundation. And they had this brilliant idea of having an agency doing this kind of work, but to do it in two things. Do work of compassion, but to do it with excellence. Really do very high quality legal services for people. But this was the brilliant part, was to do it through a network of volunteer lawyers. And that way, you could stay a lean organization and perform tons of legal services. So, last fiscal year, our agency, with an intrepid staff of 13 people, which is the largest we've ever been in our history, had about 300 volunteer lawyers doing our cases. We did about $3 million worth of free legal services for people because we had that network of volunteers. And most of our volunteers are non-immigration lawyers. They're bankruptcy lawyers, merger and acquisitions lawyers, some litigators, real estate lawyers from all kinds of different practices, and they think, I really want to use this law degree to do something significant and life-changing. And when they take one of our cases, they almost always want to take another one because it's just that fulfilling. I do want to just get technical for just a moment and just talk about what it means to get asylum, what that process is like, what the law requires. So the definition of asylum is the same legal definition for refugees. And the difference between refugees and asylum seekers is refugees are identified with that status overseas and they're brought here by a refugee resettlement agency, or they used to when we used to resettle refugees. But that was a quick aside, sorry. But asylum seekers have to apply for that status here in the United States, and they need lawyers to do it because it's a very adversarial process. And if it's a defensive case, which means that somebody who crossed the border was immediately placed in removal proceedings, it's a trial in immigration court. It's adversarial. The government's represented by an attorney. The judges, at least in Dallas, most of them tend to be hostile to asylum seekers, and so it's a very aggressive, difficult case, and you have almost no chance without competent counsel. However, with the quality of legal lawyers we have volunteering for us and the amount of training and supervision we give those lawyers, we're actually very successful and we win a lot of our cases. But that's what the process is. The standard is to get asylum, you have to have a well-founded fear of persecution, and this is the technical part, because of one of five reasons: your race, religion, nationality, your political opinion, or your membership in a particular social group. So if you're coming from a place where you experience violence or harm because of a family dispute or because you experience just generalized turmoil in your country, that's probably not a strong asylum case. But if you are targeted personally because of your membership in one of those five groups, then you do have an asylum case. And that's where much of the legal complication comes in and is proving whether somebody fits into one of those five categories. Most of them are pretty straightforward: race, religion, nationality, political opinion. And those are what most of our cases and most of the cases I've handled as a lawyer have fallen into one of those four categories. The tricky one is the last one, which is membership in a particular social group. And that is a characteristic that someone has that they can't change. It's known about them in the community, and that subjects them to persecution from the country. And it's the government or a group that the government can't or won't control. So what are examples of that? The most obvious example is homosexuality. That's a characteristic someone has, and particularly in countries in Africa and certainly in some of the countries in Central America, it's very, very dangerous to be an out homosexual. And that's very well documented. And so asylum cases for LGBT individuals are actually usually pretty successful because of that. The other particular social group, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later, is there's case law that says that women that survive domestic violence in countries where they're not protected by the government is a particular social group. This was a case called ARCG, came from Guatemala. This was a woman that for many, many years had suffered domestic violence at the hands of her husband, and she had gone to the police many times. The police absolutely refused to help her, would give her some sort of, okay, well, you know, he's your husband, and send her back. And I'm not going to do that. It's worth Googling ARCG and finding it. The facts of what this woman experienced in her marriage for many years are really, alarming, disturbing facts to read. And so the court said, look, you're a woman. This is a group of people in a country where the police are not going to protect you, and you can't leave your spouse. So that's a particular social group. Well, actually, I'm going to go ahead and talk about about why that's a problem now. The difficulty with those types of cases, and it's really germane to what's going on at the border at the moment, is that and this is very new and different in terms of how the law's been handled on asylum in our country. The immigration courts, contrary to what you might think, are not part of the judiciary. They're part of the executive branch. And so they are, the immigration courts and the judges are subject to the political influence of the Attorney General. So the Attorney General took that case law, ARCG, and referred it to himself for review and overruled it. And so you've got the Chief Law Enforcement Officer of the United States actually looking at an overruling case law protection that's come out of the courts. And that was a direct effort to confront the wave of women escaping domestic violence in the what we call the Northern Triangle of Central America, which is Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And it is... Well, I can't think of another way to put it. It's really just outrageous, and it kind of takes away the illusion that these courts are actually independent judiciary. But I'm going into some detail about that because that's actually what's going on right now with all these women that are escaping. No, well, not all of them. Some of them have other types of claims. They're women that have domestic violence, not just domestic violence, but political violence. There are also, particularly from Guatemala, indigenous communities, they're experiencing violence because of that. So it's not all domestic violence, but there are an awful lot of women that are coming here escaping domestic violence, and also the just the widespread gang violence in those countries. I want to take a moment and just personalize this a bit, because it's really where my passion for this issue comes from. You know, it's very easy when you talk about this stuff to come across like you're a great guy and you're taking care of people that really need your help. But to be honest, what really I've learned over 30 years of doing this is that the people I've had the opportunity and privilege to represent are really extraordinarily brave and resilient people. And it inspires me every day to see the people who walk into our office. And to be honest with you, it's one of the reasons that I'm so angry about what's going on right now, because asylum seekers are being demonized and described in just the most awful terms as just a bunch of criminals, and people are just coming here to take advantage of our generous welfare system and things like that. And I just want to yell at people, have you ever met an asylum seeker? I've been doing this for 30 years. Not once in 30 years have I ever been asked by an asylum seeker when they could access public benefits. The very first question I've been asked by asylum seekers has been, when do I get my work authorization? When can I work? About 3 years ago, we had a client from Zimbabwe. He had he was an aid worker. They were delivering aid to villages and got crossways with the government because they were sending it to villages that were populated by people who didn't support Mugabe, who was the dictator of the country at the time. And so they stopped them and they took them to a place to torture them, and they murdered our client's friend by drowning him in a 55-gallon barrel of water. And this guy managed to escape and come here to the United States. His family moved around from place to place because the care organization was helping his family. He came here. We assisted him. We won his asylum case with really a very skilled pro bono lawyers, and then the next time I saw him after he'd won his case, he was sitting in our lobby, and I said, hey, I heard, he was a truck driver in Zimbabwe, and I said, hey, I hear you got a job. He said, no, I got two jobs. And that's been very consistent with my experience of many years. I'm just going to tell some just like really short stories that illustrate just my personal experience with the people I've had the privilege of representing. Egyptian Coptic Christians. We've represented a lot of Egyptian Coptic Christians. About 10% of the population of Egypt are Coptic Christian. My client was a dentist. rapist in Egypt, and he was targeted by these extremist groups, and they did just a series of things trying to run him out of the neighborhood, and that ultimately they broke into his dental office and beat him to unconsciousness just because he's a Christian. And I represented he and his family in their asylum case. An even shorter story is my client from Togo. I have a wall hanging in my office that he was a gift from him. He was a poll watcher. And it's really interesting. These are things that we all do as Americans. We give it no thought. We run no risk at all. But they're things that you can lose your life over in countries like Togo at the time. So he was just a poll watcher who was reporting irregularities at the poll or intimidation of voters as they tried to vote. And for that, he was imprisoned and tortured. I represented him in immigration court here in Dallas. He was a French speaker. I did all of it. It took about a year for his case to get to trial, and I told him by the time we went to trial, he was speaking English really well, and I said, but he was going to testify in French, and a lot of times in the courts, the translators can be not so great. So I said, look, if you catch the translator mistranslating your words, you correct him right then, and he did. So he at the trial, he spoke English well enough to correct the court-appointed translator. We've had a lot of clients from Eritrea. I had a client from Eritrea. Pardon me?
Where is Eritrea?
Eritrea is the little... Anybody know?
It's Ethiopia.
Correct. Yeah, it's the little tip of Ethiopia. And it was... Yes, exactly. And they signed a peace treaty this year. For the last few years, Eritrea has been known as the North Korea of Africa because it's one of the least free places in the world. And also no religious tolerance. So my client was a Pentecostal Christian. She went to a pretty large Pentecostal church in the capital, and the government outlawed all religion other than Islam, Orthodoxy, and for some reason, I still understand Lutherans. And but they definitely outlawed Pentecostals. And they came, this was a large church, literally they came to the front door, put a chain on the door, and stopped them from meeting. And so then the family started meeting together as home churches. They started arresting people in people's homes when they would see a large crowd going to a home. She said by the time she left the country, they were meeting just as a family, and they would have religious services just in that when they met together. My client got crossways with the government because they have compulsory indefinite military service in Eritrea. So she said she identified other Christians in their dorm, and so they would get together and they would pray together, they would say a prayer over their meal, or they would gather in their dorm room at night and they'd read the Bible together. And the officers found them doing that and took them out to the desert, put them in an overseas shipping container, locked them in that container, and left them without food or water for 3 days. She managed to survive that. She was just right at the end of what your body can take without water. I asked her, and you can ask yourself whether you think this is an inspiring moment as a lawyer. I asked her, so what did you do in there for 3 days? And she said, well, you know, Jesus tells us to pray for our enemies, so we pray for our captors. And I thought, what a privilege to know somebody like that, much less advocate for them. When I was preparing her case for trial, her brother, who had already won asylum, was here. And I looked at him. His daughter was in prison while we spoke. And I said, you know, I'm just struck by how joyful you are, and despite what you've been through, and despite what you're continuing to go through, and what your family's going through. And he looked at me, and he shook his head, and he said, you Americans have everything, and you complain all the time. And it's true, and it's one of the things that I love about this work, because it really gives me a sense of perspective. You know, we take the right to worship, most of us, take the right to worship freely for granted, completely. They don't. She doesn't. There's an Eritrean church on Garland Road about a mile from my house where this woman worships freely. That she does not take that for granted. That poll watcher, he doesn't take the right to vote for granted. In fact, I had a client from Zimbabwe who was in my office one day on election day. And I said, she says, this is your election day, isn't it? I went, yes. And she said, this is amazing. And I went, what? She said, there's no trucks with soldiers. There's no machine guns. Everybody's just going to vote and then going to work to get the little sticker on their lapel. And she said, this is remarkable. And to be honest, I've never really paused to reflect about the idea that we have these peaceful elections and they occur and we, and not that we don't have problems of voter suppression and things like that. I'm not saying it's flawless, but it's definitely safe now, at least. And it helps me to know that. Perhaps my favorite story of all is a client that I had from Ethiopia. And it really illustrates why I feel so strongly about this. And this will be, I'm getting the 2-minute warning because I want to leave some time for questions. So this man had been a political activist from the time of Haile Selassie. So he had been protesting the feudalistic land policies of Haile Selassie. And then the emperor was overthrown by the Marxist government, the Derg, which was one of the most violent phases of Ethiopian history. My client was a school teacher. He said he was involved in the teachers' union. One day, he said soldiers came into the classroom. They arrested him, another teacher, and 2 students, and they took him straight to prison. I said, do you have a trial? He said, no. They told us we were counter-revolutionaries. He was in prison for 5 years. They drank untreated river water for their water. They had no adequate medical care, inadequate food. He was there for 5 years. One day they came in and said, you have been rehabilitated. You might go. And that was it. So they left. So he had been a teacher. Of course, they had fired him from his teaching job because he'd been contrary to the government. So he started, well, how am I going to support myself? So he bought a bus. He and his wife raised enough money to buy a bus, and he started a little transportation business. And he used that as an opportunity to spread the flyers and information around parliamentary elections all over the country. And as a result of that, he was targeted by the government, imprisoned several times. At his trial in immigration court, he was on the stand, and I asked him a series of questions. I asked him about his activism, and I said, sir, you were arrested 5 different times, weren't you? And he said, yes. And I said, you were beaten every single time you went to prison, weren't you? And he said, yes, I was. And I said, as a matter of fact, the last time you were in prison, they tortured you, didn't they? And he said, yes, sir, that's true. And I said, describe the torture for the court, which he did. He described the details of torture that he received at the hands of the government. And I said, and every single time they released you from prison, they told you to stop your political activity, didn't they? And he said, yes, they did. And I said, and yet you continued, didn't you? And he said, yes, sir, I did. And I said, why? The 62-year-old man got tears in his eyes. And he said, because there's a price for freedom. There's a cost for democracy. And I did that for my children. That gives me chill bumps every single time I tell that story, because I realized I'm standing, I don't really know many people who have paid that kind of price to fight for liberty and democracy and freedom, and to know somebody like that and have the opportunity to go to court and advocate for that person is a real privilege. So I want to leave you with 2 things. One is an element of hope, and the other one is a challenge. And I think I'll start with the challenge. So the challenge for you is from this, I can't find the quote, so I'll just end on hope. So the hope is from, it's from the poet Seamus Heaney, who is a Nobel Prize winning Irish poet. And he says in his epic work, Kira Troy, history says don't hope on this side of the grave, but then once in a lifetime the longed-for sea change of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. And that's what we're working for, isn't it? Thank you.
2-minute warning because he asked for time to take questions.
Right.
So we do have a few minutes to do that before we move down for Compline. And so if you've got a question, if you'll stand and ask that question loud enough so the room can hear. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Chances are I will never be a lawyer or a musician to help anyone legally. What can I do as an American citizen to help you?
Someone asked that question, a panelist on yesterday. First of all, actually somebody from the Bush Institute provided, I thought, the best answer. She said, you know, politicians really do listen if you call them. And so if you call your representatives and tell them what you think and you do it in a polite, respectful way, they listen to that. And even if they're anti-immigrant, and this attack and assault on asylum seekers is new. There's always been problems with our immigration system. But the systematic assault on the rights of asylum seekers, that's unprecedented. And I think it's possible that even very conservative members of Congress will say, look, asylum seekers coming here are people, they're persecuted Christians from Iran. You know, they're women escaping rape. They're women escaping female genital mutilation. I mean, is this, we want to turn our backs on that? I know none of you do. And I think there are politicians, even very conservative ones, that don't want to do that. We need volunteers of all sorts. We are a small, scrappy organization. We need volunteer work. We need volunteer translators. We need psychologists, counselors. We need, we have people that come in and do, we have zero clerical staff in our agency. So we have volunteers that come in and do shredding and copying and filing for us. Not very sexy work, but it's got to be done, and we don't want to pay somebody to do it because we want to pay lawyers and legal assistants to work for the clients. And then my development director would come out of the woodwork and shoot me if I didn't say, and you can donate to not just our agency, but other agencies. We have a lot of really good legal service providers in the area. And people tend to be dismissive about financial support as if it weren't important, but it's actually a really critical way to support the work. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
So going back to what you were saying, is there any hope or chance that the immigration courts ever moving out of the executive branch into the judicial branch?
Helpful for you to repeat the question.
Sure. The question is there much hope about the courts moving from the executive branch to the judicial branch? Despite my promotion of hope here tonight, I'm actually, my own goals are narrower. I just really want them to stop doing evil. And then we'll start talking about immigration reform. I think it's important and necessary, but I just think that is a really big hill to climb because it's very expensive to. But you know, I heard an immigration judge talk about her job, and she said, "Look, they have a really hard job." And she said, "These are death penalty cases which are operated in a traffic ticket court environment." And they're not, and the very conscientious people, there are some very conscientious people doing this job, and they have that's another thing the government is, they place quotas on these judges. They have, like, that's not really even something you should do in donut manufacturing, much less justice. And they're just, they're put in an almost impossible position. So I'd say before we talk about that kind of thing, just hire more judges. We've had for several administrations have inadequately funded immigration courts. So no matter where you fall on the political spectrum, the idea of having enough judges to adjudicate these cases is something we should be able to agree on. It's a good question. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Been reading in the news, it seems like the U.S. has been operating against international norms for receiving asylum seekers, such as turning people away from the border, preventing them to, you know, reach an opportunity to participate. Do you have any insight into whether that's being challenged, and if so, successfully?
Well, it's very difficult to challenge things internationally, but there are lots of litigation going on at the moment. What happened was, first, the Border Patrol was informally turning people away from the border. Then the president issued this presidential proclamation that said if you didn't cross at a port of entry, you were barred from asylum. Then they started metering, which was just allowing so many people to cross at a time, and then most recently, they did this Orwellian-named Migration Protection Protocol, where we said, no, you must wait in Mexico. So we're actually delegating our humanitarian obligations to Mexico to take care of people while they wait for their cases to be adjudicated. And just yesterday, the first group that had been returned to Mexico went with their lawyers to the border to make their court date, which is very difficult. But there are lawsuits challenging everything. I don't think there are lawsuits yet challenging the migration protection protocols, but they will. And district courts have been pretty hard on almost every one of the administration's efforts to turn their back on these international obligations and our obligations under American law. Yes, sir.
Of all the borders, north, south, east, and west, do you have an idea of how many people seek asylum each year in the United States?
You know, I'm not so sure that statistic is kept. So the Border Patrol keeps statistics about each of their crossings. Historically, the Rio Grande Valley has been a really big place for crossing, as the crossings in Arizona and also the big one across from Tijuana. So those are places lots of people apply. And then we have statistics about how many people are applying for asylum. But I don't think anybody's putting that together as like this many people cross the border. They're more like broad numbers that get tracked. And the government is not really terribly, like Border Patrol releases their numbers, I think every month, maybe even every week. There's a lot. One thing that has changed, and some of you may have already read this, that's recent, is of course we all know that migration and apprehensions at the border have been declining for some time. Fewer people are crossing. But what has happened is that the type of migrant has changed. So the Border Patrol is seeing fewer single men from Mexico who are coming here to work and more entire families from Central America. And that's part of the thing. And that is a challenge for the system, because Border Patrol stations are not equipped to take care of babies. You know, they're not equipped to, I mean, you get Border Patrol guys that are law enforcement and they're making sandwiches and things like that, which they're completely ill-equipped to do. And so that situation on the border has really overwhelmed them. I'll just add real quickly, 2 weeks ago I got the opportunity to go and tour the two family detention centers, the one at Dilley and the one at Carnes. The one at Dilley is female head of households, and at the moment there were about 1,500 people there, women and children, and just look at them, the sea of women pushing their babies around in strollers. And I was there, thankfully, with a group of pediatricians, one of them Colleen Kraft, who is the former president of the Academy of Pediatric Medicine, and that's when we identified that there were actually babies there, and they complained to Homeland Security about that, and they released 12 babies out of Dilley after that visit, which was really gratifying. That was a real long-winded answer to your question. I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am.
What happens with asylum seekers who are denied asylum? Are they automatically deported back to their home country? Are they allowed to apply to Canada or somewhere else?
They
disappear into the system.
Well, I do think people do disappear into the system. People are, if they're really in danger, they're not going to go back. And there are some countries like Eritrea that I think even unsuccessful asylum applicants, we don't return them to that country because it's known that this is just such a terrible place. But definitely people get deported that lose their cases. And there have definitely been at least anecdotes of individuals from Central America that lost their case, were deported, and were really killed quickly by gangs because they're these little villages. People are paying attention to who's coming back and who they threatened and who ran and when they came back. So sadly, yeah, that happens. Yes, sir.
I wonder how we can pray for you and who else we should be praying for beside you.
Thank you. I'll tell you my prayer every day. I get up in the morning and I read a psalm and I pray the same prayer every day, and you can pray this for me. I pray that I will lead with integrity, skill, wisdom, courage, and humility. And I think my primary responsibility, honestly, is to be a good shepherd of the people that I work for. This is very, very hard work, and none of them are doing it for the money. And the thing that's the most traumatic at the moment, like really care, people that are working in caring professions, they often struggle with compassion fatigue and post-secondary trauma because of the stories they hear. But what my staff is experiencing is more the fatigue of futility, of doing everything right, and it's not like we represent lots of unaccompanied minors from Central America. The government is taking a very, very recently starting to take a very adversarial position on these kids' cases. That's very discouraging to my staff because we work really hard to do high quality work, and when it's not successful, that's discouraging and feels hopeless. So pray for me that I'll be a good, effective, humble leader for my staff, and pray for my staff that they will persevere and look at, like, activism. It's not short-term work. You know, you have to be willing to work. There are activists that work in civil rights and the rights of LGBT and trans folks that you know, labored for decades. And that's the mindset we have to have. Thank you very much for asking that. And then there are others. We have a lot of good legal service providers here, RAISAs, Catholic Charities, Mosaic Family Services, and one, there's a couple, bright spots or silver linings. There's much more collaboration from agencies than existed a couple years ago. I had lunch today with two lawyers from other nonprofits, and we were talking about sharing resources and how to collaborate better. And then, financial support. We're getting a lot more financial support from other places in the United States, and that's gratifying. Thanks for asking that.
We have time for one more question, and then we probably need to wrap up and we'll pray.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you think that we as the public hear the right story?
One thing I would say is, I don't know if you've seen this chart. There's a really great chart that says, okay, if this is the spectrum of news. And if you get on the edges to the right and the left, there's stuff that's utter nonsense, that's propaganda. And then towards the middle, you have things like The Economist, BBC, news organizations that are really not, they don't have a real strong point of view. They're trying to report facts. And so the more you put your energy into finding really reputable, reliable news sources, the better informed you're going to be. Because, I mean, it's all I can do. There's plenty of that valid information. It's all I can do to keep up with it. It's just ignoring all the noise, because there's tons of noise. There's lots of opinion. It's like, don't get your news from Facebook. Okay, this is just a. we'll end on that tone of that wise word.
Yeah.
Thank you. This was awesome. This was awesome. Yeah. It really was. Yeah.